You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
What does it really take to run a restaurant today? When we sit down to dine, most of us experience only the magic, the lighting, the menu, the meal, the atmosphere. But behind that bite, it's an entire ecosystem, one that supports over 500,000 independent restaurants across the country and employs nearly 15 million people, making it the second largest private sector employer in the United States. In fact, restaurants now account for over 55% of all household food spending in America. But while we're enjoying our meals, the restaurant industry is struggling to hold it all together. This is One Bite is Everything, the podcast that connects the food on your plate to the rest of the world, one bite at a time. It's astonishing how many connections can be made from just one plate. I am your host, Dana DePrima, and we have been bringing you weekly episodes since 2019 with some of the most interesting thought leaders, chefs, farmers, policy experts, professors, and even comedians. I'm so glad you're here. One Bite is Everything is in the top 5% of podcasts globally and part of Heritage Radio Network, home to the leading voices in food. Today, we bring you two of those voices. In this episode, I am joined by two powerhouse women working to change the food industry and to address some of its biggest challenges. Mary Sue Milliken, acclaimed chef, restaurant owner, and activist, and Liz Murray, the COO of the Marlowe Collective. Together, they have co-founded the national coalition MORE, Movement to Organize for Restaurant Equity. Mary Sue and Liz are working to build a more just, sustainable, and inclusive restaurant industry, one where workers can thrive, women don't have to choose between parenthood and their careers, and restaurants don't have to choose between paying farmers fairly or staying open another month. We talk about why mid-range restaurants are disappearing, how immigrant labor and mental health intersect in the kitchen, and what's really at stake if we lose the restaurants that serve as the heartbeat of our communities. This episode isn't just for chefs or restaurateurs. It's for anyone who's ever eaten out, anyone who cares about food, fairness, or the future of our economy. Because the truth is, if restaurants fail, we all lose something. Let's get into it.
In a fully realized world, diners would be able to hold the complexities of the industry and the intersection it has with so many different advocacy issues across the country and still be able to go and enjoy the lighting and the service and let go of everything that's happening in the world for a few minutes or mourn or celebrate. You know, that is the entire purpose of these spaces and the communities they serve. And like Mary Sue and I know, the back end of that, the back of house part of that is full of deep complexities and hits at really, I mean, I think some of the most polarizing issues of our time. I mean, thinking even of what's been happening in LA in the last couple of weeks, you know, we are a powerhouse industry that's the second largest private employing industry in the country. Huge numbers of immigrants, people of color, people from all different kinds of educational backgrounds, and provide incredible opportunity for economic mobility and advancement to everyone who walks into the industry.
The U.S. restaurant industry relies heavily on immigrant labor, particularly from Latinx communities and other people of color, with immigrants making up over 20% of the entire restaurant workforce. These workers fill crucial positions from dishwashers to line cooks and are often willing to take on low-wage, physically demanding jobs that many native-born workers avoid. However, the recent surge in ICE raids has thrown this workforce into disarray, with immigrant workers fearing deportation and absenteeism rising as a result. The uncertainty created by these raids has led to labor shortages, particularly in kitchens, where the loss of skilled workers, many with decades of experience, can hurt food quality and service. Studies show that 73% of restaurant workers are people of color, making them integral not just to the operational side of the restaurants, but also to the cultural and social fabric that many establishments thrive on. As ICE raids disrupt this critical workforce, restaurants face increasing challenges in maintaining their workforce stability, leading to a ripple effect of lost wages, heightened fear, and deteriorating job security. The loss of such a dedicated labor pool leaves restaurants vulnerable and strains the industry, which is increasingly relying on immigrant workers to stay afloat in a competitive, low-margin environment.
I'll add that, you know, I just came back yesterday from Chicago, from the James Beard Awards, and Bobby Stuckey said it so well, that we are here for the single moms, the previously incarcerated, people of color, immigrants who are new to the country. Our industry is here with open arms. And I think that people really do care deeply about their communities and their restaurants and the places that light up the street corners in their neighborhoods and create that social fabric and energy for their communities. But I don't think they realize how tenuous and how, you know, on the wire this industry is sitting, especially right now. The financial model for restaurants has been declining in its stability for, I mean, I've been a chef since the late 70s, and this is the worst I've ever seen it. Every time a restaurant goes out of business, it's a real hit to the community. It's a hit to the workforce, to people who love to go there and can no longer go there. And I think that it's really time for us to elevate this problem and really, you know, talk to legislators, talk to the dining public, talk to the workers and the owners, and really figure out how we can put our industry on a much more stable track.
I think that's because we all share ownership of these spaces in some way, because they are such critical gathering places for our communities, right? So if owners and operators believe that, obviously workers are going to work there every day. Diners are, you know, we need these third spaces in order to continue to connect on a community level. So if we are all committed to that belief, then I think we all have a responsibility to look at it really critically and try to elevate the issues that the industry is facing.
Let's dive into that a little bit, into what some of the issues are that are going on within the industry.
Well, I think one of the things that surfaced also in our first conversation is that owners and operators are running out of levers to pull, right? So if the cost of everything is increasing exponentially, then when you really look at your mission or your values of your individual restaurant, it's getting nearly impossible to say, I want to buy good food from farmers in my community who are growing it responsibly and sustainably. I want to provide good jobs, economic mobility opportunities for the people who work for me, because I understand that's critical for the financial well-being of my entire community. I want to use service providers who are local instead of using the really giant, which most small operators don't have the opportunity to do that anyways because of economies of scale. And so you get to a place where there's really no wiggle room. And if you can't afford to pay yourself at all, you know, at some point financially, you can't afford to run the business anymore. So I think that's where we are. Our initial conversation was like, how do restaurateurs decide, you know, if I can't do all of these things and they're all important to me, do I decide to pay people well? And the flip side of that is that I have to buy commodity, you know, potatoes or meat or whatever. So unfortunately, I think for a lot of operators, when it comes down to, I can't pay myself and I can't fulfill the mission or the values that I started with, what's the point?
I actually started working in very, very expensive high-end French restaurants, you know, Maxime's of Chicago, Le Perroquet. My business partner worked at Mommy's Own with Wolfgang Puck way back in the day. But you'd look out at the parking lot and there would just be Rolls Royces and Mercedes.
Right.
And when we opened our first restaurant in 1981, we made a really conscious decision. We wanted to cook food that all our bohemian artist friends could afford to eat, and a place that really wasn't you know, Per Se or the French Laundry or even Chez Panisse. We really wanted a place that was, that served our, a different demographic. But as Liz says, every lever that you try to pull in order to be able to keep your food accessible to a broad number of people have been diminishing and diminishing. And as each cost goes up, I mean, Susan and I are guilty of staying in business far too long when we're losing money. You know, we get attached to our teams. We keep thinking we can turn things around. And now with tariffs and with immigration reform that isn't even on the horizon, and immigrants are a huge driver of our workforce. And so it really feels like it's becoming almost impossible.
And if you scale back up to that 35,000 foot view, we know from the data that this is what's happening in the industry. It's what's happening in the country, right? Is that there's very little middle, right? Which are restaurants like Mary Sue's talking about. Her restaurants, our restaurants are the same, where you want to provide good, healthy food at a reasonable price and employ people in jobs that you feel proud to offer. That sector of this industry is disappearing. And we are going to very quickly, I mean, in the next decade, be left predominantly with very high-end restaurants that have essentially perfect price elasticity and could charge $600 a person and no one would blink an eye. And then we'll have, you know, I'm in Houston, and so Whataburger.
Mid-range restaurants in the United States are facing significant challenges, with many closing at a higher rate than both high-end and budget-friendly establishments. According to a 2023 report from the National Restaurant Association, the number of mid-range restaurant closures has increased by 30% compared to pre-pandemic levels, highlighting the strain on the sector. These restaurants are struggling due to rising labor costs, which increased by 13% in the past 2 years, inflation, and supply chain disruptions, which hit them harder than other segments. While high-end restaurants continue to thrive by offering exclusive experiences, racking up a 10% revenue increase in 2023, and budget-friendly eateries benefit from their lower price points, mid-range spots are squeezed from both ends. Changing consumer preferences, with more people opting for either upscale dining, up 12% in demand over the last year, or quick service meals, which have seen a 20% increase in visits, have further contributed to the decline. Many long-standing mid-range establishments in cities like New York and Los Angeles have closed, and the broader trend shows that these restaurants are less adaptable to shifting economic pressures. To survive, some mid-range restaurants are pivoting to delivery and takeout models, integrating new technologies, and redefining their business strategies to cater to evolving consumer needs.
And I think getting into the blame or shame game about those two options is not what any of us are interested in, but it is a way that we do want to be able to preserve this middle space that really provides all of these things: healthy food, good jobs, community space for as many people as possible, and help these restaurants continue to thrive long term.
Well, it's interesting because the demand is not decreasing. The amount of meals eaten outside the home just is on a constant incline. But I think people are having to, you know, buy more meals at Trader Joe's that they reheat, or, you know, it's much more of a isolated experience. I mean, I fell in love with the restaurant industry because of the community, really. Yeah, I just, same. You know, the community in the kitchen, in the back, the community when you walk out front and meet your customers. I mean, my first job was in a donut shop. I was 14, and every morning I'd go in and fill the donuts, and then I'd change into a little pink dress and I'd go out and I'd serve them. And I'd love that feeling of connecting with somebody in their morning ritual. And those are things I think we need as a society.
You guys are obviously very deep in the industry as professionals. You understand the industry very well, and you see what the problems are, and you're working to correct those as you're working in your own restaurants, but you're also doing something else. You're taking a stand and you're trying to make some changes industry-wide. Can you explain what those are and how that started?
Yeah. I'd say on a personal level, I think both are very important to me, right? I think doing the work at the micro level day to day, having teams, understanding what that's really like, fully grounded in the reality of what that is, and working in partnership with other people, with other organizations to understand not just what's happening in New York, but what's happening in LA or Charleston or Houston or Chicago to get a sort of global view of what's happening in the industry. And because I think the work that happens in partnership is, and I sort of hate to use this word, but essentially it's magical, right? Like I think what happens when you bring like-minded people together who are all moving in the same direction, like a real platform of partnership and collaboration is greater than the sum of its parts. So I've been doing that in a lot of ways and studying that deeply probably since 2018, 2017 with the founding of Women in Hospitality United, which was really meant to meet the Me Too movement. But, you know, and Mary Sue and I have talked about this so much, but when you start to pull one thread of what the issue is, you just grab three more threads with it and you have to really like go all the way to the roots of the problem. And then that work ultimately transformed through COVID to start with initial conversations with other organization leaders saying, how are we going to work together more intentionally, knowing that this landscape is going to change dramatically in the next 12, 24, 36 months, so that when we come through this, we're stronger and stronger together than we ever have been versus letting this further fragmentize or silo all of the work that's happening in the industry.
The need is so urgent. And being women in the industry, we really are born collaborators. And it's painful to see really great work happening in New York with, you know, career development and figuring out all kinds of ways to upskill people in a quicker way and not be able to share those best practices really broadly in several other communities. I think being able to see all the good work that is being done and not being able to, you know, pull people together to really, no one needs to invent a bunch of new wheels.
We don't have time to your point, it's too urgent.
Yeah. There's great work being done all over the country in terms of supporting the workforce in the hospitality industry and in terms of driving that economic mobility for the workers while also thinking about how to support owners, operators, and help consumers understand what it is that the industry is facing so that they can be intentional about spending their money where they really want to support.
And one of the reasons that this conversation very quickly goes to economic mobility, not just in helping owners, operators get a handle on their P&L and their financials, and then if they're successful to grow, right, which the critical drivers of our national economy, clearly given our size and scale, but also every restaurant spends the majority of every dollar they make on the people who work there, right? So it's critical, like more so than most industries, right? The majority of our P&Ls are on their people. And so I think the more we can focus on retaining top talent or like attracting top talent into this industry, developing that talent, creating professional pathways, career pathways for people who want to commit their lives to working in it, the stronger individual restaurants will be, and then the stronger local economies will be. And right, it just goes from there. So to Mary Sue's point, a lot of the work that's happening right now has been focusing on how we attract and develop talent and develop real economic mobility pathways for people working in this industry.
And when you say the word talent, you're not just talking about the chef de cuisine.
No, because every single person, I mean, this is like the deep truth of it. Every single person who works in a restaurant is absolutely critical to the experience that the diner has, right? And the dance of how those people work together in tandem, right? The choreography of that is part of the magic. But no, it's not just the chef de cuisine. I mean, I think more than any other space I've ever worked in, it's just every piece of this work is incredibly collaborative.
And I'd say the most personal part for me is the heartbreak I feel when I see women, really talented women, choosing to opt out of this industry because it is so hostile to parenting and they're in love with this industry.
The U.S. restaurant industry can often feel hostile to parenting due to long, irregular hours, low wages, and a lack of benefits like health insurance or paid leave, making it difficult for parents to balance work and family responsibilities. A study by the National Restaurant Association found that 44% of restaurant employees have children, but only 27% have access to paid sick leave, and even fewer have access to paid family leave. These challenges are compounded by the industry's work hard, play hard culture, which prioritizes work over personal needs and the physical and emotional toll that demanding shifts can take on parents.
They really want to give more to it, but, you know, finding childcare, getting maternity leave. So that's a reason that I'm really excited about partnering with organizations even outside the restaurant industry, like Paid Leave for All or the Oxfam initiative domestically that they're doing about the care economy, you know, really trying to figure out how to bring the voice of the hospitality industry into those discussions in a strong way.
And one of the reasons behind this coalition, right, is that together as an entity, we're big and strong and much stronger, right? So to Mary Sue's point, and I love that you brought up the caregiving piece because it points to, as business owners, we need partnerships with organizations like Oxfam, like Paid Leave for All, but we also need partnerships with our local and state and federal governments, right? So in New York, the Marlowe Collective offers 35% of an employee's salary for 12 weeks for paid family leave, right? They can take that in the first year in because of the way the New York State works in any way they want. The reason we offer 35% is because the city and state cover the other 65%, right? So employees are kept whole for the entire period. And every New Yorker pays into this, right? It's like part of the social contract of being a New Yorker. And so 35% of an employee's wages for 12 weeks is not insurmountable for us, given the number of people who are, you know, regularly taking that kind of leave. 100% would be. So to the point of the coalition and the point of some of the advocacy work some of our members are doing, we really need these partnerships between local, state, and federal government in order to close the gaps that we're seeing that sort of make it unsustainable for women, parents, all different kinds of people to stay in this industry long term.
So your organization is called MORE. And in addition to the partnerships, you have some very specific tenets that you focus on. Can we go through those?
Yep. Yeah. So, and it took us, you know, Mary Sue, what, almost 2 years to get really clear about this because, like I was saying a few minutes ago, the scope of the problem is really big. And it's very hard to tease out, like, we could have kept going and kept going, but we wanted this work to be really intentional and focused so that we were able to make it, you know, real impact. So, our two pillars are advancing economic mobility and advancing workplace protections. And we think of workplace protections as the, you know, wraparound supports that are required in order to make this workplace, this industry, sustainable for people long term, in addition to the economic mobility, right? So broadly speaking, those are the two sort of issue areas we're focused on. And when we think about economic mobility, we're thinking about it in terms of workers, operators, owners, and ultimately also providing, to Mary Sue's point from earlier, spaces where people can still get affordable, healthy meals that bring them joy.
And there's training. You've developed training. Is that right?
Sort of. We are, you know, as you've gathered from this conversation, every one of the founders wears a lot of hats. A lot of our members develop and provide training, right? And then one of the things that we're working on with one of our members is a manager training institute. One of the big issues that the industry has is that there's almost no barrier to entry. You just need to show up consistently and show up on time and more or less you'll find a job somewhere. And, you know, depending on your interests and ability, continue to grow in that job and elsewhere. But the jump from, particularly for women and people of color, the gap between that first job and your first manager job is really hard.
Research shows that while women make up 51% of the restaurant workforce, they occupy only 28% of managerial positions, and people of color face similar disparities. Implicit bias, discrimination, and a lack of mentorship contribute to this gap, as women and people of color often have less access to the informal networks and career opportunities that help propel others into leadership roles. Additionally, a work hard, play hard culture in many restaurants prioritizes aggressive, dominant leadership styles, which may disadvantage those who lead with a more collaborative or empathetic approach. Women and people of color also face significant pay disparities, with women in the restaurant industry earning 21% less than their male counterparts, and people of color often earning less than white workers for similar roles.
And we know from economic data, from some of our research partners, that we know there's a broken rung for women in advancing to their first manager job. That's the big broken rung in economic advancement in this country. But for frontline workers, there's two broken rungs. It's the first broken rung to a manager job, and then the next broken rung to any kind of corporate job, right? So because the base of this industry is so large, we have a lot of frontline workers and very few sort of corporate jobs, not even executive jobs, but corporate jobs in general. And so we are trying to help close those gaps to provide long-term exponential financial growth for the people who work in this industry.
I'm very excited about the work that Liz is heading up in New York City, which is bringing together four or five different organizations, which in LA, we have some very similar kinds of organizations exactly. that I've known about for years. But the way that we're using MORE, the coalition, which is named after the movement to organize for restaurant equity, being able to see the progress in New York and then bring it to LA and jumpstart that same kind of progress is very exciting for me. And I'd also say that I think having more women making decisions in the industry, I'm positive that that is going to be an automatic improvement in the way we manage our people and the way we care about our communities. So breaking down the barriers to advancement for women and also breaking down some of the parts of the industry that are so hostile to what women need will be just a huge benefit to the industry immediately.
I mean, yeah. What's the plan to bring on restaurants? What's the incentive for restaurants to join across the country? How are they finding out about you guys?
The thing about MORE is that we're a coalition of organizations. And to date, all of our members are nonprofit organizations. And then those members have members of their own organizations, right? So like an individual restaurant, if you're in LA and you're women owned, might join Regarding Her, or might join IRC, or get involved with James Beard's advocacy work, or work with the workforce development organizations that are members of ours. So there's lots of ways for individual restaurants to get involved in our members' work, which then rolls up, obviously, into what the whole coalition is trying to do together. But right now, there's no like membership for restaurants.
I think restaurants are going to take notice, and we just launched 2 months ago.
Yeah.
And so we're in the phase of really getting our message out there. And thank you for having us on this podcast.
Yeah.
But I think that restaurants are going to take notice, and they're going to now be more connected to the work that Southern Smoke does, which is around mental health, which right. is also an area that restaurant employees historically and notoriously need more support in their mental health. And so it will just keep on making those connections. We see
exactly.
ourselves as just a constant connector between the restaurant industry and this work that's being done to create a more sustainable and more, you know, safe and thriving industry.
And at 2 months old.
Well, 2 months and 4 years
yeah.
of planning. I mean, we really started planning. It was just Regarding Her, Women in Hospitality United, and we brought in the James Beard Foundation, which was fantastic because the impact work that they're doing is so big. But we, the three of us, have been able to really, you know, there's probably a handful, maybe six or seven of us, that just have been meeting every week for a long time.
4 years.
Okay. Yeah. So at 4 years and 2 months of age, I'm curious what's on your wish list for the next year.
Ooh.
Money. Yeah.
We definitely are deep in a fundraising cycle and just getting the programs that we've been working on behind the scenes for the last year. You know, we started inviting members to join the organization, the coalition, formally last year, and then had a year of behind the scenes working together, meeting virtually and in person before we launched publicly, because we wanted everyone to feel really bought in and clear. You know, the work has been very intentional. So my big wish is the programs that we're sort of sprinkling ideas about here that are in, you know, different stages of development in the background, that they come to fruition. And then, to Mary Sue's point, that restaurateurs feel connected to the coalition because the services that we're offering them are meaningful and valuable. And that, like, a restaurateur in LA has some sense that, oh, this program, you know, also launched in New York and it's going to launch in Houston, and just that they're connected to the work that's happening at the national level, even though what happens day to day in restaurants feels very rooted in the specific place in the block that you're on, even, you know, because, and I know this has come up over and over in this conversation, this connection and the feeling that you are connected to and have resources from the industry as a whole is critical to advancing change here.
Mary Sue, do you have anything on your particular wish list?
On the wish list, I think, you know, getting the word out as fast as we can and getting people to understand, really educating all the stakeholders, the diners, the owner operators, the workers, and of course, our government, about the necessity to really see change happen quickly in the industry. I think that is my biggest wish. And I think a lot of the things that we need will fall into place from there. Well, I think more funding will come. You know, this work has been so satisfying, I have to say. And like I said, I just came off the James Beard Awards and I was very moved by all the speeches and all the awardees, the honorees, you know, being so passionate about the industry. It just kind of refueled my love of this work.
And I've said this over and over the last 2 years, but because of the size of the industry, we are the second largest private employing industry. We contribute $700 billion a year to our national economy. If we can make these changes in this industry, there's just such enormous opportunity for there to be ripple effects to other industries that employ a lot of frontline workers. You know, I can see sort of the, not even 35,000, but like way up, where 2 years down the road, when this work feels like it's humming along and successful, that, you know, to Mary Sue's point earlier, we're partnering with other organizations doing similar things in healthcare, or Oxfam's really ambitious national programs, or Guild, or Jobs for the Future, people who are doing really incredible work that a lot of business owners aren't connected to, right? But we're the drivers of the economy. And so we need to be.
We are so lucky that Mary Sue Milliken and Liz Murray joined us here today. Two women not only shaping the restaurant world from the inside, but also refusing to accept the status quo for an industry that feeds us all. Today, we heard about the crumbling middle of the restaurant industry, where it's getting harder and harder to pay fair wages and stay afloat all at once. We learned how immigrant labor, childcare policy, and mental health are all deeply tied to what's on your plate. And we saw how organizations like MORE are working to build an infrastructure where workers, owners, and diners all thrive. Here are a few things I hope you'll walk away thinking about. When you spend money at a restaurant, what kind of system are you supporting? Do you know the stories behind your favorite neighborhood spot? And how might we all help to preserve the middle ground, those restaurants that aren't fast food or fine dining, but make our communities feel like home? Because here's the truth. Restaurants aren't just businesses. They're culture, care, and community. And when we lose them,
we lose more than just a place to eat. One Bite Is Everything is about connecting what's on your plate to the bigger picture, your health, your neighborhood, your economy, and yes, your country. We're on the front lines bringing you the voices you might not hear elsewhere and the conversations that connect the dots. If this episode made you think, I'd be so grateful if you'd leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or share this episode with a friend. Special thanks to Sonia Dillon for co-producing this episode and to Russell Chapa for sound design, engineering, and the original music you hear throughout the show. I'll be here again with another episode next week. And until then, stay curious, stay hungry, and remember that every bite tells a bigger story.